Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Folks, you recall over the weekend, Iran sent over 300 munitions utilized in a coordinated attack on the state of Israel. And Daniel DePetris, Defense Priorities Fellow, whose areas of expertise are the Middle East policy, Iran, drone policy, diplomacy, counterterrorism, as well as international relations, joins us. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Newell. Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I don't really know where to start on this conversation other than, and I would just simply ask, does a state of war now exist between Israel and Iran?
I think technically, yes. The problem is both parties, Iran and Israel, are doing the best they can to ensure that, you know, this mini war, as I like to call it, doesn't blow up into a major conflagration. And I think that's probably what the Israelis and the Iranians are trying to do. It's sort of like a symbolic exercise where they're sending missiles and drones in each other's directions, yet at the same time they want to make sure that it does not blow up into a region-wide conflict. So that's where we are at the moment.
So, I mean, how long does this continue to go on? We know that the Iranian proxy forces that lie within Hezbollah, Hamas, Fatah, Yemen with the Houthis, and the list goes on, they continue to bomb Israel and send munitions into Israel almost every day. They've been doing it for years. When do you get to the point where enough is enough? I mean, I just find it kind of interesting. We all know that these proxy forces behind this event on October 7th, which was horrific, the Israelis take out one of the leaders of these proxy forces that happens to be an Iranian general. And now there's retaliation for same. And it's as though none of this ever happened when we're asking for everyone to exhibit restraint at this point in time. And I always try to put myself in other people's shoes. And I wonder if this happened to the U.S., what would our response be? I mean, in modern times, I think back to 9/11. It wasn't an exhibition of restraint.
No, it wasn't. And if you recall, you know, before in the days after the October 7th attack, President Biden, you know, publicly and said, basically told Prime Minister Netanyahu that restraint is probably, not only a smart policy, but he went out and said, don't make the mistakes that we made post 9/11. There's no question whatsoever that the Israelis are under a lot of pressure with the Iranian proxies, particularly Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has been, you know, they've been launching drones and low-level rockets and precision-guided munitions into northern Israel since really October 8th, the day after Hamas's attack. So there's no question whatsoever that the Israelis are under pressure. And I personally view that the Israeli strike in Syria against, you know, that senior Iranian general as sort of a messaging exercise, telling the Iranians that we're running out of patience with all these attacks and that, you know, if the opportunity comes, we will target your people directly.
Well, why wouldn't they? I mean, they have, everyone has actionable intelligence over what actually happened, both the U.S., Egypt, Qatar. I mean, it's the world's worst kept secret, right? I mean, it's kind of ironic that we look at these acts, you know, of people that are coordinating the death and destruction of Israel as that there should be some safe harbor for them.
Well, the problem is that you know, there is a safe harbor. You know, we don't like that, but that's the reality. And the Israelis are, you know, they live in a very tough neighborhood, and they have lived in a tough neighborhood since the State of Israel was founded in 1948. So it's not a conflict, you know, it's not a conflict resolution problem. It's a conflict mitigation problem. So the Israelis have made the calculation that, you know, the best way to keep our people safe is to engage against Iran directly. And we saw that, you know, 10 days ago with that attack. Of course, there's costs and consequences associated with that. And that's basically what we saw over the weekend when Iran retaliated with that massive drone and missile barrage against Israel. So it's a very dangerous time. And I think the administration is probably burning up the phones with their Israeli colleagues saying, look, we don't want another round. Obviously, the decision to retaliate is up to you. But from the U.S. perspective, we don't want this to get out of control. And that's priority number one for the White House at the moment.
But it's not unlike we haven't been subjected to some of the same conduct exhibited by Iran, right? I mean, their proxy forces, the Houthis, firing upon U.S. ships. Iran just now took control of a ship in the Red Sea. They continue to engage the U.S., not only some of our military installations in the Middle East, but some of our fleet out there in the Strait of Hormuz. Is there a line, or is that something that's just imaginary? I mean, we will take whatever they have to offer. I guess the question is, when do we cross the line? I mean, does Israel get to set a line now, or there's never going to be a line as it relates to Iran?
Well, I don't know if there is a line. I think your last option is probably the case. You know, the Israelis have made it abundantly clear that, you know, if the Iranians don't restrain their proxies in Syria, Lebanon, and in Gaza, the Israelis will escalate against Iranian generals, against the Iranian military. And that's sort of been going on for quite a while, honestly, but it's never been as brazen as it was last weekend. So we've sort of gotten a step above the escalation ladder here. And I think the United States understands that. And, you know, the priority, like I said before, priority number one is to make sure our troops in the region don't get swept into a major, you know, conflagration between Israel and Iran, which is a very difficult thing to do at the moment.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting to see how this ultimately plays out. Are you confident that there's an end game here?
I believe it's my personal opinion that if the Israelis do not retaliate, as they have been talking about over the last 24 to 48 hours, we might get back to the status quo ante, which was, granted, the status quo wasn't exactly stabilizing, right?
But we kind have of butt ugly. I mean, to put it in plain street terms, right? I mean, I don't know how else to describe it.
You're absolutely correct. But the problem is, you know, in the Middle East, there are no good solutions here. So we have butt ugly or extremely butt ugly. Those are our choices, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. we try to make the best of the reality that's presented to us. And I personally think that if the Israelis mitigate the retaliation option, you know, or don't retaliate at all, this could not necessarily blow over, but we could get back to the point where we were 2 or 3 weeks ago, which granted was not great, but it would be better. It would be far better than the alternative of a more violent conflict.
where we find ourselves today in the aftermath of the actions of Iran over the weekend, is this better as it relates to negotiations for a potential two-state solution, or does it make it more complicated?
Well, it makes a very complicated issue even more complicated, right? Even before these strikes against Israel, the two-state solution, there have been no negotiations in over a decade for a two-state solution. And part of that is basically because, you know, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu does not want it, doesn't believe that it's in Israel's interest to, negotiate one. And the Palestinians are all over the place in terms of their politics. So brass tacks, it probably doesn't make whole much of a difference, because the two-state solution at this point, I'm sad to say, is probably an imaginary, formulation. And it's a lot of U.S. policymakers don't want to admit that, but I think that's the scenario we're looking at right now.
Yeah, because that was going to be my next question. Why are we holding on? Why do we have this death grip around this policy position of a two-state solution? Only because it placates some of the far left here in this country politically for this administration?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's a matter of, it's always been U.S. policy. Part of it is inertia, right? So it's always been U.S. policy to advocate for a two-state solution. And it's been like that for four or five consecutive presidencies, Republican and Democratic. That obviously is not happening at the moment. And we've had many negotiations in pursuit of a Palestinian state. None of them have panned out. And essentially, this is our only option. It's either a two-state solution, or we allow Israel to basically have a perpetual, occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, which I'm not sure is in Israel's interests. And quite frankly, it would take an enormous amount of resources for Israel to do that in perpetuity. So again, this is the least bad option on the table. Even if, if we're being straight up honest, it's the chances of getting a two-state solution at this point is about 1-2%, if not lower.
If we go back in time before October 7th, because a lot of people still are kind of confused why this happened on October 7th. Why were the Iranian proxy strategies put into place that brought about this horrific attack on October 7th? And I'm just kind of curious your thoughts about that. My thoughts are simply that, that the Arab nations and Israel were coming closer and closer together. Sunnis would be empowered. Obviously, that is not what the Iranians and Sharia law, they have no comfort in that. And that's kind of what brought us to this conflict relative to the further embracing of the Abraham Accords or the continuation of same. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But before the attack, the United States was sort of an intermediary between the State of Israel and Saudi Arabia. And the goal there was to essentially establish normalized relations, which would be a very, very big deal in the region and almost topping the Abraham Accords in the Trump administration just by virtue of Saudi Arabia's stature in the Arab world. That obviously did not serve Hamas's interests. The Iranians did not want that. And a lot of the Iranian-backed rejectionist groups in the region didn't want that. So I'm sure that was probably a factor in Hamas's decision making, but I'm not sure it was. It was probably one factor among many. It wasn't the sole factor.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it? I guess I'm coming back to the U.S. I mean, we have to recognize, same, that they are a disruptive, destabilizing force, and it mystifies me why we have this death grip on this two-state solution, where even public opinion polls amongst the Palestinian communities are still, the vast majority believe that from the river to the sea, and that Israel has no place in the Middle East at all, historically or otherwise. And we know that that's not true, but they continue to embrace that, but those are the folks that they want Israel to negotiate a two-state solution with.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting to the point where it's not just Palestinian public opinion. It's a lot of Israelis do not want a two-state solution either. And, you know, they have a lot of the Israeli population has a lot of problems with the current Israeli government. And, you know, Netanyahu is not exactly a popular figure now. But it seems, based on the polling that I've read over the last 2 or 3 years, that they actually agree with the current Israeli government's approach towards the two-state solution, which is we don't want one. Right. So we have the United States has a situation here where we're sort of shouting in the wind, saying this is our policy. We want you to work towards a certain outcome, when in reality the dynamics are just they're just not in place for that outcome. It's unfortunate, but that's the reality here.
Yeah, I just I just don't understand where the end game is and how this is gonna end up. I mean, and the only stabilizing force or the only protection that we have, both from actionable intelligence and everything else, is predominantly the majority that we get is from our ally Israel. You know, and there's so many others that have been on again, off again, friendly. I would never call them allies, but, you know, friendly more often than not sometimes historically. And we find ourselves turning our back on our most trusted ally there. And it just I can't wrap my head around it as to, you know, why we find ourselves in the predicament that we find ourselves in. And we keep begging for something, as you point out, is really a pipe dream at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of it boggles the mind. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying that we're not supporting Israel. I mean, we clearly are over the last 6 months, especially in Gaza, where we've basically given them carte blanche to do what they need to do with Hamas. And, you know, that's a whole separate conversation. But yeah. You're right. Look, I mean, the United States does not have great friends and allies. And I mean, technically, Israel is not even a U.S. ally. We're a strategic partnership with Israel.
Strategic partnership, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what that means. It kind of reminds me of Animal House double secret probation. these terms of art, you know, what's the old Shakespearean saying? A rose is a rose by any other name. I think they're on our side at the end of the day.
Right? Yes.
Well, I, you know, this is what, and you know, you're expert. You have an expertise in this field. How frustrating is when you assess all of this and trying to pull it together and put it in its appropriate silos and figure out where we are and where we're headed? I mean, are you as frustrated as I am? And I mean, I don't know half of what you know. And I'm just confounded by a whole lot of what goes on here.
Yeah, I mean, the experts, right? I don't consider myself an expert, by the way. I think expert is a term that's used way too often in this field in general. But I do watch the region very closely, as do many other people. And I think there's a collective realization that U.S. policy simply is not working in that region, has not been working over the last 20 to 30 years. And yet they're... is sort of an aversion within the U.S. government to changing it and to reforming it, right? So, you know, it's not a surprise that we carry over a failed policy. I mean, it's happened for the last 3 decades. If we don't have the backbone to change it and refine it in certain ways, then we're going to get the same results. So it certainly is frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel DePetris, thank you so much for joining us, Defense Priorities Fellow. Truly appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
You too. Thank you.
That's Daniel DePetris, Defense Priorities Fellows, areas of expertise, Middle East policy, Iran, drone policy, diplomacy, counterterrorism, and international relations. We will be right back, 504-260-1870 on the Okunar Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.